Sometimes you just want the quick facts. No opinions, no speculation. I'm Claire Thornton, an audio editor with USA Today. My team works around the clock to bring you the Five Things podcast. Every morning, me and my co-host Taylor Wilson help you know what to keep an eye out for that day. We always have a fresh mix of stories, from politics to entertainment to sports, covering all parts of the country. On Sundays, you can lean back with in-depth episodes about stories you may have heard earlier that week. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite shows and start listening to Five Things today.
Inside Florida Politics, powered by the USA Today Florida Network. Trump clinches the GOP presidential nomination before Florida's primary. The Florida Republican Party's legislative wish list gets the cold shoulder from GOP lawmakers, and Rick Scott considers a Senate leadership bid. Hello, I'm USA Today political reporter Zach Anderson, and those are some of the stories I'll be discussing this week with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. But first, well, gentlemen, we're past Super Tuesday now. A lot of numbers this week in the world of national politics and Florida politics. What do you have for us today, John?
Zach, I'm here with an 84 this week.
And how about you, Antonio?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to have a record number. I don't think we've ever had a number this high. 60 trillion.
60 trillion. Wow.
60 trillion.
That might be the top.
Antonio's going into the stratosphere here. Well, I'm a low man this week. I don't know if we've even been in the trillions before. Yeah, you're breaking new ground here. I'm the low man this week with a five. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, both Antonio and I were at Mar-a-Lago this week for Trump's Super Tuesday election night party, and there was very little drama as the former president rolled up victories across every Super Tuesday state other than Vermont. Nikki Haley dropped out of the race the next day and 13 days before Florida's primary, which already was mostly meaningless and now is completely irrelevant. Haley didn't immediately endorse Trump, saying he needed to earn the support from her voters. Trump promptly took to True Social to declare that Haley got trounced and to deliver some parting shots. Antonio, it wasn't really the unity moment that some Republicans may have liked to see.
You're right, Zach, and we didn't have any drama Tuesday night, but we did have plenty of drama on Hump Day Wednesday with that exchange between the two of them, and it certainly was not a good look for unity as you'd start pivoting toward the general election in November.
Yeah, it was nothing like what happened with DeSantis when he dropped out of the race. I mean, no. he didn't really shower praise on Trump, but he said, you know, the Republican voters have decided here, and he endorsed him immediately. He didn't, wait around or let there be any mystery about it. Haley, well, completely different here.
Yeah, because what she said wasn't that. She said it's Trump who has to earn the trust and endorsements of the voters that have voted for her, which in normal political eras, that would have been, a fairly innocuous statement. But in MAGA world, that's a declaration of war. But you know, to be honest, that's not really the problem here. The bigger problem isn't so much whether Haley endorses him or not, or whether she bends a knee or not. The larger issue right now is these percentages that she had been racking up in all these contests. Let me read you a few here. Colorado, she got 37%, 30% in Maine, 38% in North Carolina, 37% in Virginia, and 43% in New Hampshire. And those are going to be battleground states in November. And the reason this is a problem is, and I was talking to some folks this week, and one of the things they pointed out is that, generally speaking, what we've seen in this primary isn't that unusual. You do have these moments where you have a challenger to the main candidate, but then once that candidate wins the required number of delegates, everybody kind of falls inside, or as one told me, they all come home. And the reason that this is an issue is that it's not really clear that the so-called Haley electorate will come home to Trump. They could stay home. They could not vote. They might vote for another candidate. They could vote for Biden. Who knows? And one of the, there was a poll that came out this week. With
right. Actually, Antonio, I've been doing some reporting on that this week. And it does seem like Haley voters are, to a large degree, fundamentally different than Trump voters and DeSantis voters. You know, DeSantis seemed to be really making a play for more conservative voters, trying to pull some voters from Trump. Some of the Haley voters I talked to said they won't support Trump, or they're very skeptical about supporting Trump. It seems to be that she did coalesce a group of people who, we talk about how Trump has come to dominate the GOP, and he has, but there still seems to be this group of people, and some of these primaries were open, a lot of them were, so there were Democrats and independents voting, but still a significant number of Republicans who are very, very skeptical of Trump.
Well, in the FAU Main Street poll, 28.5% of the Republicans in the poll cited a number of reasons why they are having trouble voting for Trump. And that's a big number. And if you don't believe that, then I just have one phrase for you. Look, fellas, I just want to find 11,780 votes. That's the phone call to Georgia from 2021, early 2021. Why is that significant? Because if you look at Georgia, the reason that Trump lost that state in 2020 was because there were thousands, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 Republicans who voted that in that election, November of 2020. They voted down ballot, pretty much Republican, but either didn't vote for Trump, left a blank, or may have cast a vote for Biden. So this is not hypothetical. This is not theoretical. This is a problem that Trump has to address. And as we heard at Mar-a-Lago from the likes of Byron Donalds and Marjorie Taylor Greene, that's not their game plan. Their game plan is, we're MAGA, you need to come to our side. It's not that we need to moderate ourselves, or that we need to pivot or somehow water down the MAGA agenda to make it, you know, tasteful for you.
Well, I think what their game plan is, Antonio, is to just make Biden so unpalatable for these people, to try and just make him toxic in the minds of Republicans and swing voters. And, you know, they've done a pretty good job of that throughout his presidency. You look at his low approval ratings, and, you know, I have talked to some Republicans who don't particularly like Trump, but they can't imagine voting for Biden. And I think that's partly because of, you know, when he ran in 2020, he was viewed much more favorably, and his negatives have gone up considerably. And so it'll be, you know, a very negative campaign on both sides. Both of them are going to try to disqualify the other side, which is not unusual in politics, but there seems to be very little positive that we're going to see here going forward. Up next, Florida Republicans snub their own party's legislative wish list. While Trump rolled to victory, Florida lawmakers rolled to the end of the 60-day legislative session without approving some of the more hard right bills that have been proposed this year, a departure from recent sessions when such legislation received a lot more support. The Republican Party of Florida's legislative wish list was mostly ignored, a notable snub from a legislature dominated by the GOP. John, what happened this year?
Yeah, really seeing, you know, for the first time in the DeSantis era, we have witnessed Republican legislators stand up to the governor on some issues, and also to the Republican Party of Florida, which is something of an extension of DeSantis and, well, Donald Trump, too. But, you know, this pushback by lawmakers, I think, also points to a divide within the GOP. Within the Republican Party, the side that's allied with Donald Trump is huge. But there is another wing, as we saw evidenced with the Nikki Haley campaign, that seems to want to return to a more normalized form of government, and a return to the party's heritage, maybe, of being concerned about foreign affairs, government spending, and, you know, advancing priorities key to the business community. That's what Republicanism was for a long time. Now, into that divide, the Florida Republican Party this spring put forth a 10-item wish list that was for the legislature, and it included support for a lot of the stop woke kind of bills that have been part of DeSantis's brand, you know, like putting an end to the use of preferred pronouns, banning governments from putting up pride flags, and even banning the removal of Confederate monuments around the state. Well, you know, seven of the 10 items failed in the legislature this spring. Mostly it's because Senate President Kathleen Passidomo, she pretty much stayed true to her earlier stand that she didn't want to take up a lot of these controversial, divisive bills that also spawn a lot of debate with Democrats.
That's kind of a return to the Senate's sort of historic role, right? I mean, oftentimes the Senate at the national level and at the Florida level has been a bit of a moderating force on politics. You know, you have people who serve for longer terms. They tend to be more experienced lawmakers. They represent bigger districts that can be a little bit more diverse. And oftentimes they'll kind of put the kibosh on proposals that they don't view as, you know, having brought enough support or not ready for prime time. That kind of went away over the last few years in Florida. Is you think that that's coming back?
Yeah, it does seem like at least the Senate was where a lot of this stuff died this year, and the House was eager to go ahead with a lot of it. So, you know, even within the Republican ranks in the legislature, there's a little bit of a divide. So, you know, it's a time maybe for Florida lawmakers to reevaluate the power of these stop woke ideas, which, of course, you know, have been central to DeSantis, but which, as we look back, you know, failed to provide him with that much firepower during his presidential run. One Republican legislator, he told me that the party's top 10 was way out of line. He told me that the party is basically going through its own civil war, and that maybe this session will be remembered as one of those early battlegrounds, at least here in Florida. You know, of course, that's not to say that Florida is changing much. There are still Republican supermajorities in the legislature. The governor's office has been in Republican hands for the last 25 years. And now there are about 800,000 more registered Republicans than Democrats in Florida. So, you know, you have a lot going that this state is turning pretty red. But looking ahead to elections this fall, this session and the dial back on some of these culture war issues, it might be possible that some in the Republican majority have concerns about how their party and its candidates are going to do when they go before voters, maybe especially when they're led by top of the ticket Donald Trump. It's hard to look up and, you know, beyond the recent successes of Trump in the Republican primaries, where, you know, he just swept Nikki Haley off the field. But, you know, maybe rank and file legislators are sensing that voters are looking for a kind of return to normalcy in their politics.
It also seems to indicate that maybe a lot of the hard right stuff that we saw over the last few years really was about helping DeSantis with his presidential campaign and running in a Republican presidential primary in places like Iowa, where he was able to get lawmakers to go along with this stuff to help him out. But there's maybe not as much urgency right now.
Yeah. So, yeah. It seemed like, you know, he did see the political relevancy of it going into a presidential campaign, but it didn't really pay off for him in the end.
Up next, Rick Scott weighs a bid for Senate leadership. Well, moving from the Florida legislature to Florida's congressional delegation, U.S. Senator Rick Scott said this week that he's considering a bid to replace Mitch McConnell as Senate GOP leader. McConnell is stepping down later this year. Scott met with Trump this week to discuss the leadership race. Antonio, your team broke this story. What is Scott saying?
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting. I'm going to give a shout out to our colleague Stephanie Matat, who was with us at Mar-a-Lago, from where she actually broke the story. But basically, you know, when the news broke last week that Mitch McConnell, who's been the Senate Republican leader for almost 20 years and a member of the Senate for about 40, that he would not seek to remain as Senate leader on the GOP caucus after the November elections, you know, the immediate thought was Rick Scott, because Rick Scott did challenge him unsuccessfully at the end of 2022. But at the time when Stephanie first reached out to Scott, he was noncommittal. He issued a statement that was, you know, focusing on his race and so forth. And then this past Tuesday, when we were at Mar-a-Lago to cover Super Tuesday, Stephanie actually at one point while we were waiting to get into, we were in the security line to get into the ballroom where the festivities were to be held. Stephanie was actually in this grassy parking lot under the palm trees interviewing Rick Scott. And basically, he told her that he is considering running for the GOP leader spot, whether it's minority leader at the time or whether it will be majority leader, depending on how the 2024 elections break, one of the two. And more importantly, he said that actually he had been at Mar-a-Lago the night before on Monday night to talk to, you know, former President Trump and the leader of the GOP to ask to talk to him about another bid for Senate leader of the GOP side. So it looks to be at least something that is seriously being considered.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if this is a real serious thing. I mean, Scott has signaled for a while that he's interested in leadership, maybe even interested in running for president. He's had a bit of a feud with McConnell, but he's still a relative newcomer to the Senate. He was first elected in 2018. So going for leadership at this point, when there's a lot of people who have more seniority, who have built more relationships with him, seems to me like a bit of a long shot. But then again, you know, if he can get Trump's endorsement, then that's really probably the main thing that matters. So who knows?
And and Zach, and we don't know what the Senate ideological makeup is going to be after November 2024. For example, some of the people that are being talked about, John Thune of South Dakota, John Cornyn of Texas, they're two that have that kind of veteran experience that have been around. But you know what? They're also part of the McConnellist, quote unquote, establishment. Yeah,
they're seen as part of too close with McConnell, too close with the establishment. Anybody who's been in leadership for any length of time seems to get the ire of the GOP base, like we saw with Kevin McCarthy and others. It's like the longer you stand at the spotlight, the more they're going to tear you down. And so, you know, maybe it's something where Scott maybe has more of a chance because he's a fresh face or somebody that doesn't have that baggage in the party.
And somebody who has MAGA credentials. He was behind Trump going way back to 2015. Similar political trajectory, businessman that takes on politics. He's seen as kind of this outsider. He has a lot of money. He can raise money. You know, can he get the half the senators and the GOP caucus to vote for him? He might, depending on how
the makeup is. It also is one of those races, though, that it requires a lot of kind of subtle political skills and interpersonal relationships that I don't know if Scott has those or not. So
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if in the Trump political landscape that applies anymore.
We'll move on to some numbers. John, you want to tell us about yours?
Yeah, Zach, I came here with an 84, and that's the number of Florida state troopers and quick response officers that Governor Ron DeSantis had ordered last week to South Florida for deterring possible violence at spring break. The force is headed to Miami Beach and that nearby area, but more officers are likely to be dispatched to the Panhandle beach towns and the Jacksonville to Daytona Beach area. Now, it's remarkable. You know, DeSantis made a big deal about sending Florida State Guards to the Mexico border to blunt migrants trying to enter the U.S., And for DeSantis, of course, that's designed to score political points by taking his flight at the Biden White House. But dispatching a state police force in your own state to stand up to spring breakers, that's a different story for DeSantis. And, you know, the governor, though, he seemed to acknowledge that many beach communities have been seeing spring break crowds get out of control. And there's been some, you know, ugly shootings, violence, scores of arrests during these spring break activities around the state, you know, predominantly in South Florida. It seemed to be some of the worst mayhem, but in past years. So, you know, maybe some level of heightened law enforcement is needed this spring. But, you know, there's a kind of a lot of irony here where we all remember, you know, the governor getting a lot of questions back in 2020 during the height of COVID-19. When the governor kept Florida beaches open while, you know, he did shut down beach bars and restaurants right around the time of spring break. But, you know, spring break crowds have gotten bigger in recent years and, you know, more guns are present than ever before, it seems. And local law enforcement clearly can get overwhelmed. So, you know, DeSantis sending in the cavalry here from Tallahassee seems really designed to avoid the risk of more violence and bad headlines for the state. But that's quite a number of people that he's dispatching to stand on guard for, you know, all these beach bars that are around the state right now.
Yeah, I saw that he was using drone. They're going to use drones to monitor spring breakers.
Yeah,
they're going to run their license plates. And one Democrat was tweeting, so much for the free state of Florida. So
yeah,
all depends on the situation.
That's right.
Antonio, you want to
if you have a fake ID, it's not free.
Well, it's kind of hard to top that, but I'm going to try. I'm going to explain the $60 trillion I just dropped on you guys. As in $60 trillion, and I'm going to take us back to Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday night to Mr. Trump's victory speech, in which he talked about, for the first time in a long time, the pandemic. And he mentioned that globally, that the economic damage from the COVID-19 crises totaled some $60 trillion. And what struck me that is that, look, the pandemic, arguably, when the history books are written in the last century, the pandemic will rank up there with the biggest, national crises of the last 100 years, the Great Depression, World War II, the September 11 attacks. And yet it is an issue that is as fresh in our minds as it is. It's an issue that has not resonated at all in the 2024 political race so far. When Biden, President Joe Biden, came to Jupiter at the end of January, he gave a speech in which he dedicated one paragraph to the pandemic. Trump never talks about it. And in fact, at Mar-a-Lago, when he raised the issue of the economic damage from the pandemic, he basically said that, that's something he admitted that he never talks about it. And then he went on to the grievance that he doesn't get credit for it, and maybe they should get credit. And it struck me that, that it's kind of interesting that given how important this is, it's not even a political issue at all. And the question is why, and maybe it's because nobody's going to win here. People don't want to be reminded of the economic shutdown, of losing their jobs, being in food lines, losing, their businesses, and suffering the way that they did. But nonetheless, here you have Trump now saying that he should get credit or not. And, that's how his administration, the way that it handled the pandemic, will be up to them, up to historians and and public health scholars in the years and decades to come. But let me throw out two numbers out there that are also kind of important. Trump didn't mention this, but according to global tallies, there are somewhere between 6 million and 7 million reported COVID deaths, since 2020, of which the United States has about 1.1 million of them. So even though we're 4.3% of the nation's population, we are still, we account for somewhere around 17 to 20% of the deaths, which is a staggering number for a country as wealthy, advanced as the United States. And, whether Trump gets credit or not, that's for historians to decide. But he's not made the political case. He's not issued the narrative to explain why he should get the credit. And whether he talks more about it or not, we'll see. But again, it struck me how this issue, as important as it is, it has just not been part of the political discourse at all for the most part.
Well, you saw how much Ron DeSantis talked about it during his presidential campaign. He really wanted to take credit for, keeping the state open and all these things, and it didn't help him at all. It didn't do anything to move the needle. And probably one reason they're not talking about it is they pull these things, and it must not really register at top of mind for a lot of voters in some of the polling. So, well, my number is 5, as in it's been 5 months since former Republican Party of Florida Chairman Christian Ziegler was accused of rape. And this week, the police finally wrapped up their investigation into that accusation, and they determined that they were not going to file any charges against Ziegler. State Attorney Ed Brodsky, who covers the Sarasota region where Ziegler lived, put out a press release this week that said they were not going to move forward with video voyeurism charges against Ziegler. They earlier had announced that he wasn't going to face charges for rape or sexual assault in this case. And, at this point, he has been completely exonerated legally, but his political problems, he's already, kind of hit the rock bottom politically. The party in January removed him as Florida GOP chair. And his political career at this point looks like it's in shambles. But some people might be wondering, now that he's been cleared, could he make a political comeback? Will we see Christian Ziegler in Republican politics going forward? I think a lot came out during this investigation about his personal life, about him having sexual encounters with women who weren't his wife, sometimes with his wife being involved in them with threesomes. And, you know, that some of that stuff could make it difficult for him to mount a political comeback because of the juxtaposition between his moral crusading, holding himself out as a champion of traditional values, of family values, while behind the scenes engaging in behavior that doesn't appear to be traditional for most people. Then again, former President Donald Trump is facing 91 felony charges and only seems to have grown more powerful politically. So who knows? Anything can happen these days. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio guru, Rob Landers. Thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.